issues and really trying to find the points that way. So, and we were also taught a very gentle needle technique because we used to treat a lot of children as well. And, you know, when you're treating a child, you don't really get a second chance. It's got to not hurt right away. And so we were taught a very lovely technique where the needle insertion is so fast that the body barely even registers the discomfort there. And so you can put several needles in without even noticing. And so, and then a lot of abdominal acupuncture, which I still use in my practice quite often. And so very heavily influenced by Dr. Bai.
What kind of needles do you use?
I use regular filiform needles, regular stainless steel needles, nothing too fancy. But I also don't buy very cheap needles. I like to spend a little bit more because I think that the quality is very important. Less possibilities of breaking needles, which I have seen many times, less of a chance of dull needles, and also ensuring that there's no potential allergic reactions and stuff, which I haven't seen very often, but there are people who discuss that possibility. So I just err on the side of caution and buy good quality needles, typically from Korea, actually. I do like the Korean style needles.
Which modalities do you regularly employ in your practice?
Primarily in my practice, I would say 70 to 80% of my practice is herbal medicine. That is where my area of focus has always been. I do love acupuncture, don't get me wrong, but herbal medicine really is my primary objective here. And you know, I do a lot of acupuncture as well, and cupping and moxibustion. But I think that a lot of times people ask me why I do mainly herbs, and the reason behind that is because a lot of my patients who are coming in here have a lot of deep-seated chronic conditions. They've been going on for a long time. And in my opinion, and this is really only my opinion, in order to truly affect the person's physiology on a very deep systemic level, we need to employ herbal medicine. And I mean, in my experience, in my very limited experience, really, I have seen herbal medicine truly, truly exert profound, profound, miraculous effects at times.
In your opinion, what are the main factors in our society that cause illness?
Many factors. I think that currently we live in an age of, you know, environmental issues. I believe there are emotional conditions as well. I think it's a high stress, you know, we live in high stress societies now. People are, you know, struggling to get by, struggling to afford to live, especially in an area like where we live, right? Very, very expensive. And so that's a very big stress for people. You know, I think with the advent of smartphones and stuff, we're seeing a lot more postural issues and stuff. So we're, you know, we're getting a lot of patients with issues resulting from overuse. But we're also, you know, I think diet is a major, major factor. I think that there's been depletion of our soil. There's been a really, really big drastic change to the quality of our food over the last 20 or so years. And I think that when you combine poor diet with a lot of emotional distress, maybe poor sleep, it is a recipe for disease.
What are the main illnesses that you deal with in your practice?
I deal with multiple illnesses. I consider myself a general practitioner here. Lots of internal medicine. I do see a lot of autoimmune conditions here, very common, and digestive issues. I treat a lot of dermatological issues, primarily in small children. There are a lot of children that come to the clinic here, and for them, it's typically we see the triad of atopic conditions, things like eczema, allergies, asthma, and a lot of pain, of course. I think that most people associate Chinese medicine and acupuncture with pain, but we, you know, we're really trying to change that, not stigma, but we're really trying to change that mentality of a lot of people and to show them that Chinese medicine has this ability way, way beyond just treating simple pain.
In your opinion, what are the main differences between Chinese medicine and Western medicine?
I think it's similar to what I alluded to previously. I think that they're both very complementary. I mean, if we look at the systems, how they're run in the mainland in China, everybody essentially is working together. It's not really an ego war. I think that what happens essentially, in my opinion, is Western medicine far excels Chinese medicine at acute emergency conditions. I mean, if a patient breaks their leg, I don't want them here. You know, go to the hospital. You do that, you know. I mean, with the advent of antibiotics and certain emergency procedures, we really, really have this very advanced system. We've got brilliant, brilliant technology to really assess diagnosis when it's used properly, of course. And where I think Chinese medicine very much excels is in the treatment of chronic deep-seated, long-standing conditions, and in patients who really are not being offered a lot of help by their medical doctor, either because they are frustrated because they're just not getting better, or because their underlying lifestyle choices and issues are keeping them from actually getting better. So we like to talk to our patients about every aspect of their life to see if we can figure out the underlying issue here.
How open are Western doctors to working together with TCM practitioners?
I think it depends on the doctor, of course, but I've seen in the last 10 or so years a dramatic change. I think that 10 or so years ago, getting referrals from Western doctors, they were few and far between. I mean, it takes a while to earn a reputation as well in the community, but I think nowadays it's a completely different ballgame. And I'm not really sure why that is. I mean, maybe there's more discussion of it in Western medical schools, or they're just accessing more of the literature because there are a lot of studies that are coming out over the last few years. But now I've got medical doctors that are patients. I've got very, very good relationship with several medical doctors in the community who refer patients here quite often. So I think it's a really great environment, I think, currently. And that's my experience. I'm sure other people have different experiences, but my experience has been a very positive one and has really, really evolved over the last 10 years.
Do you see Western medicine and Chinese medicine working together in the future in North America? And how would they best work together, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I think that that is the ideal situation. I think that there are places where this is happening already. I know that there have been trial clinics that have opened up in British Columbia years ago. I know that in America this is also happening. There is definitely integrative clinics that are opening up. I think ultimately the best strategy would be to utilize each other's strengths and improve on each other's weaknesses. I think that having the best of both worlds really is in the best interest of our patients. As practitioners, we need to realize and understand our own limitations within the medicine, know what we're able to treat, what we're not able to treat, and utilize each other's strengths in that regard.
And that was the first half of an interview with Dr. Avon Evan, a clinic owner, acupuncturist, herbalist, and scholar of traditional Chinese medicine. The CJSF 90.1 FM here broadcasting from Vancouver Burnaby Mountain. My name is Chris Spangenberg and I am the producer of this series of interviews. Now, this is the fourth episode of an 8-part episodic series on traditional Chinese medicine, also known as TCM, and the traditional Chinese medicine community here in Vancouver. In the course of these interviews, I examine the local culture and practice of traditional Chinese medicine, as well as inquire into its philosophy and difference from Western medicinal practices. This series is produced for CJSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. Today's interview is the second half of a long interview with Dr. Yvonne Evan, an acupuncturist, herbalist, translator, and clinic owner of Rocky Mountain Wellness in Port Moody. Yvonne stands out in the TCM community for his interest and scholarship in classical Chinese medicine, especially classical Chinese medicine texts such as the Yellow Emperor's Classic of Chinese Medicine and the Treatise on Cold Damage Disorders. He is also involved with translation of such texts into English. In this last part of the interview with Yvonne, we talk about the differences between classical Chinese medicine and the conventional model of TCM, as well as the importance of the scholarship and translation of the old Chinese medicine texts. We begin with discussing the significant differences between classical Chinese medicine and contemporary TCM as practiced today. Next, we talk about the importance of the translation of classical Chinese texts into English and Yvonne's methods of translation. Yvonne elucidates on his call for a classical revival and briefly discusses what academic and institutional changes would best foster a return to classical Chinese medicine. We end the interview examining the Taoist origins of China. My name is Chris Spangenberg and you are listening to an interview between me and Dr. Yvonne Evan here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Significant differences between classical Chinese medicine as you practice it and the conventional model of TCM taught in modern China.
That's a very important question. I think that this is a big area of division right now that's happening is that, there's a lot of practitioners who feel that after in the 50s, when they institutionalized Chinese medicine, they really, really watered it down. They condensed it in a way that they wanted to basically educate it and teach it in a very shortened way. And so what they had done was they had diluted a lot of the old classical literature and stuff and really put a focus on biomedicalizing the medicine and putting it, into fancy little boxes and making it easy to learn and stuff, which unfortunately, I mean, this is the way it's being taught. This is the way it's being taught in the mainland. This is the way it's being taught really everywhere around the world right now. And that is what we now consider traditional Chinese medicine. And it's a very, very big difference from classical Chinese medicine. Classical Chinese medicine really puts a lot of emphasis in the old classical texts and things like the Huang Di Nei Jing, which is the Yellow Emperor's internal classic, and reading more Taoist texts and even delving into a little bit of Confucian texts, but also putting a lot more emphasis on the clinical handbooks, things like the Shanghan Lun, which I had mentioned before, and the Jingui Yawei, and many other writings that followed suit. And really, classical Chinese medicine is, I mean, it depends on who you ask, but some people will say classical Chinese medicine is, you know, up until the Han Dynasty, so it ended in the late 200s. And some people will say classical Chinese medicine is anything that refers to pre-Mao medicine. And what they mean by pre-Mao medicine is when Mao Zedong called for the revival of Chinese medicine and institutionalized it. And so it really depends on who you ask. I think that essentially, you know, there are differences, of course, in treatment outcome. I don't really know. I mean, because modern TCM, there's nothing really wrong with modern TCM. When it's applied correctly, it can be very effective. I'm by no means, you know, going to allude to the possibility that it's not effective or it doesn't work. I just think that in my own opinion, in my own love for the medicine, I think that there really needs to be a return to the classics, because I think that that's where the real medicine is. And a good analogy that one of my teachers actually used, which I really, really love, is that, you know, he likens classical Chinese medicine to a spring in the Himalayas, like a very small spring that eventually moves into a river, which essentially will continue to run along its course into a lake and then break off into trajectories and then dump into the Yangtze River and then eventually meet all the way into China, into the Bohai Sea and into the ocean. And so his analogy for that is that classical Chinese medicine is like that spring in the Himalayas. It's very pure. It's very clean. It's unadulterated, and modern TCM might be more like the meeting of the Yangtze River and the ocean, that it's gone through a lot of changes, and it might have been a little bit more murky now and a little bit more polluted. And so I think it's a bit of an extreme analogy, but I think most people would get the point behind that.
What academic and institutional changes would best foster a return to classical Chinese medicine?
Essentially, what the institutions would have to do would put more emphasis on the classics, on really, really having a classical revival and having the students read the texts more. I think that, you know, it is changing, though. There are a lot more classical courses being taught at the universities, more so at the graduate and the postgraduate level. I think at the undergraduate level, whether it's in North America or Europe or in China, there's still an expectation of you know, the curriculum that needs to be taught and stuff, and there's very little emphasis really on the classics. So you really have to get into the much higher levels, into the graduate and postgraduate studies to do that. And in fact, actually, at my university, at Nanjing University of Chinese Medicine right now, in October, they're opening up a department through the university, and it's the Jingfang department through the Nanjing University, which the emphasis there will be 100% on reviving the classics and putting a lot of emphasis on classical education and really, really focusing on the Shanghan Zabinglun and all the clinical herbal texts that were so important at that time.
Where were the best experts in classical Chinese medicine to be found?
All over the place. I don't think that they're limited to just to China. There are a lot of wonderful, wonderful practitioners in China, but there's also a lot of great practitioners in North America and in Europe. I think it really depends. I think there, over the last 10 or 15 years, I really believe that there has been a classical revival. It really is different now than it was 10 or 15 years ago. And so you've got a lot of people who have returned to China, who have really worked under discipleship with very, very, very important doctors and are doing a really beautiful, beautiful job in bringing the classics back to the West, and even to the East for that matter. I've seen a lot of classical conferences happen in China that bring out hundreds and hundreds of people. So I really do think that there is really a classical revival. There's also a book that came out, I don't know how many years, maybe about 10 years ago, maybe even longer, by a doctor named Liu Lihong. He's a Chinese doctor based out of Guangxi University, and he wrote a book. It's in Chinese. I believe it is being translated right now into English, but it's called the Su Kao Zhong Yi. So it's this exploring Chinese medicine, and he really, really delves very deep into the need for a classical revival and discusses in very fine detail about the problems with modern traditional Chinese medicine and why it's important to return to the source of our teachings.
Could you talk a little about the importance of the translation of ancient Chinese medicine texts? Why is translation of the literature so important?
Because there's so little of it. I think that's the problem. I think that right now in Chinese medicine, if you were going to go into a Chinese library at a Chinese university, it is overwhelming. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books, journals, articles that in Chinese about Chinese medicine, spanning the Shang Dynasty to modern day writings. It really is quite overwhelming and exciting if you're me as well. But the rough estimate right now is that maybe 2-3% of major texts have been translated into English or into other languages. And to me, I mean, that number is far too low. If somebody wanted to really explore classical studies in English, they would be very limited. I mean, there are a number of books out there. It's much better than it used to be, but there's still very, very little. And so to have only 2-3% available to English speakers of what is available to Chinese speakers is really, it's just too little. So I believe that one of the most important things we can do right now in order to support this classical revival and to really bring back the classics and the importance is we just need to translate more and more and more and get as many books out there, as many articles as possible. I mean, this is part of why I started my case study blog many years ago, was to translate as much as possible. And also the book that I published a couple years ago is just, a small step towards adding to the literature that we've got available in English.
How many people do you know are involved in the translation work?
Offhand, I know several people that are involved in translation, but it's still a small community. I don't know the exact number, but we're not talking about hundreds or thousands, really. Translating Chinese to English is one thing, but to get into a very specific specialized field of translating Chinese medicine into English, I mean, it's quite small. It's really not big. It's not big enough for that matter. I don't know the exact numbers, but we need more. We need more.
Could you talk briefly about your methods of translation?
Sure. My method essentially is to read the text in its entirety, and then I'll read it again as best that I can, and I try to understand the methods of the writer, the writer's influences, try to really get into the head of the writer and, understand, political situation, environmental situation of that time, depending on what time period we're reading. And once I feel like I have a bit of an understanding of what the text is saying and the style of the writer and the message that he's trying to convey, then I'll start to break it down and start to translate it and really just try to break it down. I mean, it's a lengthy process. I know some wonderful translators who can really translate very, very quickly and produce beautiful, beautiful work. I'm a little bit slow in the sense that I'm very anal and meticulous about my work, and I worry about it and overthink it sometimes. So it takes me quite a bit of time. But the process is essentially read again, understand, begin to translate, and then eventually just start editing so it actually makes sense.
In your experience, what are the best publication outlets that publish translations of ancient Chinese medicine literature and contemporary Chinese medicine literature?
There's only a few, really. I think that as far as the people that are publishing, there's a publishing house called Paradigm Publications. There's Eastland Press. There's a few others their names are just slipping me right now. But I think that what's happening right now in our field is a lot of people are leaning towards self-publishing. And I think that the reason that people are self-publishing is because they've got more control of their work. And in this day and age with social media and because because of how small the community really is, it's not hard to let people know about your work. There also is a great publishing house, in my opinion, and this is the same publishing house that I published my text with. They're called the Chinese Medicine Database, and they're based out of Portland, Oregon. And their primary objective is to get as many classical texts translated as possible. And I think to date, they've published probably about 9 or 10 very important works. And the fellow behind that project, Jonathan Schell, is really, really committed to getting as many books out there as possible. And I think what they're doing for the field of classical Chinese medicine is truly amazing.
How has your experience as a student and translator of the Chinese language changed your understanding of Chinese medicine?
I feel like I had to relearn the medicine. I think that once I started to learn Chinese, I went back to a lot of the basic textbooks, and because I felt that I wasn't being given the whole picture. You know, a lot of the books that we were using in school in English weren't necessarily translations of mainland texts or anything. A lot of these texts were writers' opinions of the theories and philosophies behind the medicine. And I mean, there were some good ones. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some great English texts out there. But I feel like I really had to go back and learn. And I think that one of the greatest things that I've experienced and that I've really noticed is understanding the nuances behind certain words, where you're taught that a word can mean something, and you attach your clinical perspectives and your strategies to that word, whereas in Chinese that word can mean many, many things. And it's learning how to interpret those words that really opened up a lot for me, and it really helped me open up the possibilities to a lot of classical texts. I think that a lot of people feel that a lot of these texts are very limited, and how can we treat, modern day patients with books that were written 1800 years ago? And I think the problem with that is that people are not reading between the lines. And again, they're not really understanding that this is a physiology based medicine, and that really physiology hasn't changed in 2,000 years. The body still reacts the way the body reacts. External influences are different, but it's still going to react and change very similar.
In your view, what are the most important medical texts of Chinese medicine still in need of translation into English?
Too many lists. There are so many books, but I can say from my own opinion, and this is probably based more on my preferences, is more commentaries on the classical texts. It's a great tradition in Chinese medicine to take an old classical text, for example, the Shanghan Zaping Lun, and write a commentary on it. And that would just literally be that writer's interpretation. And that is where I spend a lot of my time reading. I read a lot of commentaries. There's a lot of really great writers and thinkers in Chinese medicine over the last 2,000 years, clearly. And so I think that we really need to focus on translating a lot of these commentaries, because they're just too good and can really, really open up a whole new perspective for practitioners.
How can the TCM community better support this translation work?
I'm really not sure. I think that the problem, essentially, I think that a lot of people don't get into translation because it really does not pay very well. And I hate to bring up the money thing, but that is probably essentially what's inhibiting, and that is probably the greatest impediment to producing more translations, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of commitment, a lot of sweat and tears to produce a translation. And if people aren't being supported, I mean, if people aren't buying the texts, or if people aren't being able to fund the work, it's just not going to happen. And I totally get it. I mean, it took me 2.5 years to finish my text. And that's between running a clinic and having a family and stuff. I mean, it kept me up many nights, and it's a lot of work. And to not get paid to do these things, it has to be a labor of love. But at what point do people still need to eat and live? So, I think that essentially it's a monetary issue, unfortunately.
Could you talk a little bit about the current state of scholarship in traditional Chinese medicine?
I'm not really sure. I think that, you know, like I said before, the undergraduate level is the undergraduate level. It's not really any different than it is in China or North America. I think it's all essentially very similar. I think that in the graduate and postgraduate level, I think that depending on who you're studying with or what school you're studying, the scholarship can be extremely, extremely high. I mean, you know, I've had classes in China which were not very good. I mean, the scholarship was very low, and it really wasn't anything new, or it wasn't anything that we hadn't already delved deep to at the undergraduate level. But I've also been through classes or been sat in clinic with doctors who just blow your mind, who the scholarship is just so high, and there's really a very, very strong knowledge of classical medicine and old literature. And so the scholarship can be very high. As far as how the scholarship is in North America, I can't really speak to that. I'm really not sure. I've been out of school for a while now, so I'm not really sure what the current state of the education is out here.
Could you tell me about any specific areas of interest that scholars of traditional Chinese medicine in North America and China are currently focused on? Just some broad areas.
I think that right now, in my experience, there are two schools right now of thought. There are the scholars that are focusing all their energy into research and trying to prove theories and trying to almost biomedicalize the system, which there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's science is great, and Chinese medicine, I think in the right format and the right process, can really hold up to the rigors of scientific study. And then there is the school of thought that is heavily based on the literature, on the classics, and really focusing on that.
In your opinion, what could be done to improve the scholarship?
In North America, I think that what is essential would be to teach more Chinese classes. I think that there are a couple schools. There's a school in as far as Canada goes, the only school that I'm aware of is a school out in Nelson that does have a Mandarin element to their program. There's a couple great schools in North America that are also teaching Chinese. And I personally think that that needs to be the focus. I mean, of course, the medicine is important. I think that it has to be taught from the perspective of the classics all the way up to modern works. But I really think there needs to be an emphasis on medical Chinese. People don't have to learn conversational Chinese. They can just learn how to essentially read medical Chinese, because once you can read a little bit of medical Chinese, your entire world is going to open up as far as journals, as far as research, as far as classical texts. I mean, it really opens up an entire ocean of information that is otherwise not provided in the North American education.
How much interest do local practitioners show into the traditional Chinese medicine scholarship?
To be quite honest with you, I'm not sure. Some of the people that I associate with that I know are very, very heavily into the scholarship and are, you know, arduous students of the medicine and, you know, really, really spend their entire, you know, spend their lives under this recognition that we are perpetual students and that we need to consistently learn. But otherwise, I'm really not sure.
Could you briefly talk about the Taoist origins of Chinese medicine?
Sure. I think that essentially the connection between Taoism and Chinese medicine stems back to this concept of holism and this microcosm of the macrocosm. And in Taoist literature, specifically the works of Lao Tzu, in the Tao Te Ching talks about man being a reflection of his environment and the true microcosm within the macrocosm. And you know, there's talk about harmony and about yin and yang and the five elements and how essentially we are just a reflection of our environment. However, there was a lot of emphasis in Taoist medicine prior to the Han Dynasty in immortality, and there was they would use a lot to try to achieve immortality, and it wasn't until I believe the Eastern Han Dynasty that Zhang Zhongjing, the writer of the Shanghan Zabinglun, really tried to break that down and get into more realistic medical practice, if you will, about actually treating conditions and about looking at the medicine and how it can work. Of course, I mean, you know, Chinese medicine is a holistic medicine, and it does view the environment and humans as this interconnected whole, and that, I mean, that is essentially the tenet of Taoism, really. So I think that there's a strong connection there.
Thanks to Chris Spangenberg for putting together those two interviews, and I will see you next week. Someone will be here next week. I'll be here next week, I promise. See you next time. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting.